Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, and today we have a very special guest coming to us from the capital of the United States, Washington, D.C., Mr. Will Allen, who has been an engineer on U.S. White House Air Force One during the administration of President Ronald Reagan, President George H.W. Bush, and President Bill Clinton. And his photographs of UFOs over the Capitol, Washington Monument, Senate buildings, which we'll be discussing today, are among other places in the National Geographic, which has very strict criteria for admission of a photographic collection, and at his website, which is ufodc.com. Welcome, Will.
Well, welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, we have been meaning to have you on Exopolitics Radio for a long time. And a number of years ago, we did a program with an author who's based in Los Angeles.
Robert Stanley.
Yes. And he wrote a book based on your work.
Yes, he did. And by the way, he wanted me to say hello to you.
Oh, good. Good. And that was a very impressive and a very important program, and it's a very important book, and it's all based on your work. Now, we actually finally met face to face in Washington, D.C. at the recent X conference in May of 2010, and you were able to share with me some details of your life experience, which I was not aware of, but I think which bear very importantly on your work in terms of your early contact with some other intelligence. And I wondered if you could share with those experiences with our audience now.
I certainly can, and it all started for me on a military base in the United Kingdom. And my father was in the United States Air Force. My father worked in Precision Measurement Electronics Laboratory, which was a specialized field in the Air Force. And in the early 60s, as a child, my father was stationed at a base called Sculthorpe, which was right outside of Rendlesham. And we happened to live in a farmhouse because at the time there wasn't any base housing available, and we had temporary quarters in this farm area, which was a very nice area outside of Sheringham, a place called Methwall in England. And as a child, one night, I had problems sleeping as a kid, and I liked to play with my toys late at night. And, you know, one of the things that fascinated me back in those days were things that glowed in the dark. And I had a toy that glowed in the dark. And as it became dark and I was supposed to be asleep, I decided to stay awake and play with my toy. And as I was playing, the door to my bedroom burst open, and a group of 4 to 5 small gray extraterrestrials in silver spacesuits. I mean, we're talking about the grays with the bug eyes, the large heads, no real apparent orifices for mouths or nose or anything like that, just bug-eyed, big-headed aliens, came into my room and proceeded to examined my brother and I, and one of the things that was more interesting was I could hear their thoughts, but I didn't see their mouths moving. And they were amazed at the fact that the dampening fields that they deploy on all electrical impulse organisms, and people wonder why when they're around aliens they're unable to move and run, and that is because they use this dampening field which they apply to the cerebral cortex, and your mind can send a thought to your body, but your body will not respond because it is inhibited to respond to the impulses of the brain. But one of the things I noticed, though, when these aliens came in was that even though I was conscious and was able to move from my waist up, I was unable to scream. So I was also unable to run. And as I tried to scream, and I was screaming like a schoolgirl, but believe me, nothing was coming out, I started to wonder within myself, how was this possible? And understand, I'm 5 years old, and I'm experiencing, essentially, contact with an extraterrestrial. And during that visitation, they implanted me, and that's when everything started to change for me. Not only did I change physiologically, where this implant was actually starting to react with my central nervous system, and for about 18 years, every night at the same time, I would throw up, and it never stopped. And I'd go to the military doctors, and in the military hospital, they would do examinations, and no one was able to find anything, because I never really mentioned that I was implanted with anything, but they never found anything in their examination of me that would cause me to have nightly bouts of illness, especially at the same night, every night for 18 years. But after all of that stopped, I thought I was having a normal life because nothing happened. I wasn't ill anymore. I could eat again. And things appeared to be normal. I was working in Los Angeles in the motion picture business and was offered a job in the White House and decided to take that job instead. And after I left the White House, I started having full-scale close encounters. And I mean, when I say full scale, I mean spacecraft hovering above my head, objects landing, extraterrestrials exiting the landed objects, which I'll have to describe as non-corporeal because what I saw essentially and what I imaged essentially at the U.S. Capitol were anomalous sources of energy that had intelligent motion associated to them. And I mean intelligent motion in the sense that they appeared to be moving around and monitoring my actions as I was doing a job there at the U.S. Capitol building. And most of my specific data, especially in regards to the objects I encountered at the U.S. Capitol, are supported by reports which started in 1942 by RAF pilots in the air of Germany during World War II, in which they would encounter anomalous objects that would essentially pace their aircraft and fly around their aircraft and do examinations of their aircraft and then fly off at high rates. And some of these objects reported by these air commanders just happened to match exactly the anomalous objects that I imaged at the U.S. Capitol building.
Right. You call them the P-51?
P-51, Carpenter's P-51 UFOs. And that P-51 is what I was told the airspace was designated in terms of its restricted airspace. And at no time should there have been any object stationary in the sky above the Senate side of the U.S. Capitol building, because I believe there was a law passed in the 1940s which prohibited aircraft from flying over any United States government landmarks or government buildings such as the Capitol or the Washington Monument or any areas that are designated government buildings by the United States Congress.
Now, you have documented, and in fact, listeners can go to ufodc.com and see this, and we'll be going through some of the photographs of this so that you can comment on this. And these will be at an examiner.com article also. But you have actually documented in a forensic way what appear to be cycles, if I'm not mistaken, in which these phenomena recur around the Capitol. Am I putting too fine a point on it, or?
No, you did exactly hit that one on the number. It's interesting that I had a series of close encounters in July 2002. The first one started the 4th of July. The second one was the 16th of July, 12 days later, the first one being at the Washington Monument, the second one being at the U.S. Capitol building, and the third one, which was November the 11th, 2002, on a street in downtown Washington, in which I encountered two small marble-sized UFOs. One of them was pearl-like in texture. The other was a small green luminous object, green like the luminous objects that were imaged in Lower Senate Park the night I had the encounter at the U.S. Capitol building. But the difference was in this smaller anomaly, it had a blue force field directed around it, and it essentially parked itself above a lady's head, and I was able to image it in one frame of this particular encounter. But let me go back. Now, My initial encounters at the Washington Monument, July 4th, 2002, and July the 16th, 2002, were echoed. And I mean echoed in the sense that essentially the same things happened and the same things were imaged in July 1952 from the exact same location that I had my second close encounter. And interestingly enough, July 16, 1952, when a squadron of luminous spheres, and mainly spheres that were coupled, meaning there were two spheres per anomalous object, and there were, I believe, 14 of them in the air and several of them in the clouds above this formation that seemed to be stationary and serving as lookouts. And these particular objects that flew by the U.S. Capitol Dome July 16, 1952, were imaged again July the 4th, 2002, except this time my object initially during the first sample that I obtained during that night, the initial formation was 11 o'clock to Washington Monument, meaning it was that if you were looking at it as if it was a clock, the small hand would be in the 11 o'clock position, and that's where this formation of four luminous white spheres, which matched exactly the characteristics of the luminous spheres that flew by the U.S. Capitol Dome on July 16, 1952. So what we're able to do here is show through a physical sample that these anomalies seem to have an interest in specific areas of the U.S. Capitol building. And if we look at the overall design and architecture of Washington itself and proper, if you look at it from space, it has essentially the overall characteristics of a spaceport, which show clearly what could be a landing pad, which most UFOs could probably interpret if they see that in space. And, you know, there's just other physical definitions in how Washington that was designed in the early 1700s just happens to have these characteristics that can easily be ascertained from space as landing fields. So we're looking at possible interest as to why these UFOs show up here in Washington, D.C. And we're also showing that they're showing up here in numbers, in the sense that I was able to image at least for the last 8 nights here, during the last 8 nights that I was up taking photographs this last week, show with consistency anomalous objects vectoring through the sky. So it's an ongoing thing with these UFOs, and a lot of these UFOs that I am imaging here in Washington are imaged at a shutter speed. For example, I've got a camera that allows me to shoot at 1/8,000th of a second, and that's an extremely high shutter speed. Essentially, that is the highest known shutter speed known to man. And yet, some of the samples that I'm photographing at 1/8,000th of a second show blurs in the sky, which indicate the objects are moving faster than that shutter speed, which also is faster than the ability of a human to comprehend anything in terms of something in motion. So they're happening in front of us, and they're moving in front of us, and we can't see them because they're moving at a hyper-accelerated rate. And a lot of people are just not aware that the level of UFO activity is actually increasing as we come closer to 2012.
Wow. Now, there are a number of different avenues, but first I wanted to ask you this, because I just wanted to get it, I just wanted to get it correctly. Do you think that your, that the device that was implanted in you, do you think that that plays a role in your ability to photograph these anomalies?
It has a direct correspondence to the images that I'm taking. And if you notice on my samples, all of my samples are close proximity. They have no problems showing up, landing in front of me, taking off, doing all kinds of unbelievable aerodynamic maneuvers in the sky. And I do believe that my friends back in England were essentially training me for this specific application. I photographed them.
Yeah. Now, I also want to get this on record. You had mentioned to me that a very prominent advisor, both in the Clinton White House and also in the Obama White House. Would it be okay to mention his name?
John Podesta is a friend of mine, yes.
Yes, yes. That, and actually, John Podesta has himself held a press conference in the National Press Club urging that there be an open inquiry on the UFO presence, as I recall.
Yes, he had.
Now, what did he mention to you about your work?
Well, there's extreme interest in my work, but most of the response that I'm getting is not necessarily positive, in the sense that there's concern that my material, because of the graphic nature of its sample, could possibly destabilize society. Well, you know, if you look at the trends here in the United States, and essentially society is destabilized, but it's not for my photographs. It's
right.
Through other things that, through the course of the way the system is designed, are designed to self-destruct. But nevertheless, their concerns were that the materials were not necessarily appropriate for the masses to be shown. And it clearly shows, for example, that evening, and I mentioned again that I was monitored by a particular entity that was on the ground, and that entity just happened to have been what one would categorize as non-corporeal, and non-corporeal being a life form with intelligence, however, without a physical structure as we know it. And I was able to image this one specific entity in three different positions, its first position being in the rear of the park, its second position, it swam into the reflection pool and swam up behind the actual subject, which, by the way, I was doing an album cover that night for Def Jam Records. But as it swam up behind that subject, the guy just happened to turn around and look behind him and see this luminous, with what we all describe to be a large single-cell organism like an amoeba. However, it was luminous, swim up behind him and then swim back to the other side of the reflection pool as additional green and red spheres were landing in the rear of Reflection Pool Park. So essentially what I photographed was an extraterrestrial away mission at the U.S. Capitol building. They landed, and they were doing a field investigation of the building and the area around the building.
Right, right. Well, rather than destabilizing society, why wouldn't John Podesta say, this is exactly the sort of data that we need to bring to the attention of the U.S. Congress so that they would have open hearings?
Well, I attempted to make my data known to those who needed to know in the Congress itself. And initially when I had this encounter, my first course of action was to report it to the U.S. Capitol Police, which I did, and they responded with an investigating officer, a detective, who investigated me. And when I showed him my specific data, his response was, first, there was technically nothing they could do because no crime took place. I mean, when you look at it, well, no crime did take place. However, a crime did take place because we have imaged a stationary object in restricted airspace parked in the sky by the U.S. Capitol building. Secondly, he said to me that basically, Mr. Allen, all your photographs are doing is substantiating what our officers are reporting. And so it said to me essentially that, okay, well, then there are other witnesses that also witnessed this event at the time that I took these photographs. And secondly, that this is an ongoing thing, that a lot of these objects, especially, for example, Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, and Peter Robbins came to town for the First Contact project, which I was working with. And as the crew set up their cameras in front of the Capitol building, this object, which was exactly the same as the object that I imaged July the 16th, 2002, over the dome, this luminous energy source, just happened to manifest itself once again November the 17th, 2008, in the exact same position it was that I took the photograph 6 years earlier using an analog film camera, except in 2008 I was using a high-definition D700 Nikon, which enabled me to capture multiple frames of this distortion above the dome in the exact same position that it was in July the 16th, 2002 sample, with the addition of a formation of luminous red spheres, which were imaged over the Senate side of the Capitol building. And some of them were stationary above the roof of the building itself, and some of them had attached themselves to the lip of the dome, and my physical sample clearly showed this light source, unidentified light source, luminous red light source, multiple luminous red light sources in the air and attached to the building of the Capitol itself. And within itself, that said to me that there could possibly be more there than meets the eye.
Well, you're a person who's actually worked on the White House staff for three presidents. Here we have a situation where a senior advisor, White House chief of staff for one president, and the head of the transition team for the current sitting president, who himself has called for opening up the UFO issue. Then we have a situation where you've brought forensic evidence to the U.S. Capitol Police, and their response is, oh, this forensic evidence is confirming what our officers are themselves finding. Where do you think the logjam is that the U.S. Congress is not, I mean, the U.S. Capitol Police serve the U.S. Congress, you know, we have Mr. Podesta who is right there at the levers of power and could bring this matter forward. And all the public opinion polls show that the public, unlike the 1961 Brookings report, now 85% of the public says that they're congruent with the extraterrestrial presence. What do you think that logjam is there?
Well, you know, first, the United States Capitol Police are not trained for advanced extraterrestrial military or private contingents at all. They're not trained for that. They're trained for the human element, and they do an excellent job controlling the human element of that. But the issues become accountability, and that they're in a chain of command and they're in a series of agencies that are above them that really have their that have the power to do something, but it's not in their jurisdiction to do so, not at all, essentially, because the U.S. Capitol Police are not trained for an advanced extraterrestrial at all. They're not even technologically capable of seeing these things, especially based on the materials where, for example, when they did the investigation and pulled the video from the time that I took my photographs. And, you know, you're looking at a building that is the hub of the United States, and the technology there did not see what I imaged on my film sample. So it says a lot, essentially, that there's a very good possibility that the current technology used to monitor the area around the Capitol was insufficient at the time to gather the information that I gathered with my film sample.
Well, now, let's step back a bit and take sort of an historical view of this. If we go back to July 16, 1952, and we have that archetypal photo of the objects around the Capitol. I think you mentioned that there were a number of objects in a couples. Is that the photo that was run by a number of newspapers at that time?
Yes, it is exactly the photo. And there was some footage that I got from Nick Cook, who is with Jane's Defense Weekly out of the UK, and it ran on his special that I believe they got from the British Defense Archives, which showed color motion picture footage from two perspectives of this formation of objects as it flew by the U.S. Capitol Dome. And the other footage was the footage that was taken July 26, 1952, by Disney, who had a crew, I believe, that was based at the Lincoln Memorial, and they filmed a formation of luminous objects which had insectoid characteristics fly above the Capitol Dome and then warp out.
Right. Now, what was the official response? What was the official, both the executive, the U.S. governmental at the executive level and at the congressional level, what was the official response to both of the July 16th and the July 26th flyover in 1952?
At one point, I believe, the United States Air Force was order to shoot down these anomalous objects. And from what I understand, there was a battle in 1952 at the Capitol, and one of the objects was shot down. Whatever happened to its debris, I would assume that that debris was brought into the lower subchambers of the Capitol and stored. However, I think that especially the fact that my encounter was exactly 50 years, that encounter, that there was something there that they're interested in, and there's a very strong possibility they may be there trying to retrieve what was shot down in 1952. You know, it's how we obtain our technology that's really interesting, and if we look at how the advancements of man has progressed over a relatively short period of time to where, for example, it's rumored that much of the technology we're using now, especially cell phone, optic fiber, laser technology, and a few other things, are rumored to have been assimilated by the United States government during the Roswell crashes. So, you know, we look at how we make leaps and bounds and how we're all of a sudden technologically advanced, but basically what we're looking at is the advancements that we have currently are essentially the repercussions of, I would say, stolen alien technology, because we took this technology, we back-engineered it, and now we're using it for our applications in an attempt to at least do as these objects do and go forward in such a manner that we would be capable of interstellar flight capability.
Now, if we come up to the 2002 events, 4th of July, 16th of July events, which you were able to capture at the forensic level photographically, what was the official governmental response there at the executive level and at the congressional level?
Absolutely none.
Now, why the big difference between 1952 and 2002?
Well, look at how since the 80s, though actually since the 50s, when the movies started coming out with UFOs and flying saucers and aliens, we're indoctrinated to that. And, you know, it's funny. You can show somebody something and it would be so abstract and extraordinary to them that they would be able to fathom or comprehend the exact nature or value of what they're looking at. So I'm not sure why they overlook the fact that essentially there was a full-scale close encounter of the first through fourth kind at the Capitol building July the 16th, which includes landings, which includes non-corporeal extraterrestrials, which made contact. I mean, it included the full gamut of what one would consider a close encounter, and I fully documented the entire event for about an hour and a half. But yet, the physical data was essentially disputed in the sense that, well, most of the people were stuck on stupid when they looked at the sample taken from Lower Senate Park showing the formation of luminous green spheres, and it's a 3.5-minute picture of this formation of objects. And it's one object in the sky, but my photograph showed a cluster of objects in the sky. And yet, in the photographic sample itself, one of the elements of this green anomalous object completely negated Newton's laws of light and motion in that the sample shows this luminous formation of green spheres move lateral and up and upwards, but its lateral energy signature was blue, and its upward energy signature was green. And according to Newton's laws of light and motion, if a green object moves lateral or upwards, you're supposed to see a green lateral energy signature and a green upwards energy signature. And that is not what I photographed that evening. In further examining that specific sample, I noticed that the further I started enhancing the scan values, the further I started noticing that there were in the center manifestation repeating patterns in the sky, and they repeated in a triaxial manner, meaning they repeated X, Y, and Z in an exact pattern. I mean, if you go X, Y, and Z three blocks in both directions, you would see this perfectly three-dimensional pattern in the sky of this oscillating object. And essentially what that said to me was that this object, he elevated its vibrational state, its molecular structure, to a higher order in that it vibrated a hole in the sky and essentially generated what one would perceive to be as a stargate, and flew into the self-generated stargate and made its exit. Instead of just flying away, it warped into a hole, and that described essentially what happened in 1952 when the United States Air Force scrambled F-86 Sabres to the U.S. Capitol building to intercept these objects. And before the F-86 Sabres entered into the Capitol airspace, the UFOs simply vanished, and there was no sign of them. The jets did a full sweep of the area. They found absolutely nothing, radioed back to the base, indicating that everything was clear, came back to the base, and the minute they landed, the UFOs reappeared in the same position they were in the sky before the F-86 showed up. So it's showing clearly that this ability to transcend conventional space to another reality or a hyper-reality, which is a strong possibility that this object did, that I photographed July the 16th, and it shows that specifically that what we were indoctrinated to accept, for example, in terms of entertainment when Stargate, the motion picture, and Stargate, the TV show came out, essentially is true. The technology they're utilizing could essentially be one of the reasons why we see in Egyptian hieroglyphics in the pyramids in Egypt, why we see objects which look exactly like the space shuttle or Bell Huey helicopters or tank technology, which we're using currently today. How could we see that in a hieroglyphic that was then anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 years ago? It's an impossibility, other than the strong possibility that the United States government or some military faction is involved in time travel.
Now, getting back to the differences between 1952, the difference between the government response and the social response in 1952 and 2002.
Well, in 1952,
here is something I wanted to think, because I think that you've identified a number of factors. Also, we have to look at an important factor that came in 1953, possibly as in reaction to the 1952 flyover. And that was the 1953 U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Robertson panel, which laid out a series of rules which said essentially that any mention of UFOs in either the media, in a scientific or academic context, or in a governmental context, had to be subject to ridicule. In other words, it went from being okay to be on the front page of the Washington Post in July of 1952 to, in 1953, post CIA Robertson panel, it became forbidden for any mainstream media, academic, scholarly journal, governmental official at the risk of losing his or her job or livelihood to mention UFOs or extraterrestrials other than in a context of ridicule. That seems to have been part of the defensive shift that the CIA and the intelligence community ordered that the society take. In other words, they just painted the UFOs out of existence by not giving them any airplay, so to speak.
That's exactly what they did.
I
have to say that when my initial contact in the early 60s, 1962, 1961, as a child, I was compelled to tell my teachers what I saw and what I experienced, and I did. And the response was, in the DOD school, which is a Department of Defense school, and I went to all DOD schools. I lived on military bases all my life. And for the early part of those years, the response was that I had to be taken out of circulation, essentially. So what they did was they put me in a form of special ed. So they responded to my reports as a child by taking me out of the mainstream and putting me in a collective group of individuals which were deemed emotionally and intellectually incompetent.
Right, right. And all of that came about as a policy change, both inside of the military and in all circuits, be it media, education, science, government, came about as a result of the Robertson panel, which was triggered by the July 15th, 1952 U.S. Capitol flyover.
Yes.
Now,
well, a lot of that too, their data was obtained from the crashed object they shot down. But then, too, the other reports, what a lot of people don't realize, in that time, there were a lot of jets that were being destroyed in the air by UFOs, not only destroyed but disintegrated, or some jets would just simply vanish into nothing. So there are those reports of the physical effects of what happened. I don't know why I'm getting this interference here.
This brings up a very important.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we're having a bit of a your signal's kind of coming in and out.
Hold on, let me reposition myself here.
Yeah.
Maybe if I get away from this technology.
Yeah, yeah. So you bring up a very important question. Insofar as you've been able to determine, why do you think that there was such hostility behind the 1952 phenomenon and the 2002 and 2008 and 2010 phenomenon?
Hold on, I'm losing you.
Oh.
I'm losing you. Let me try to take myself a little bit out of the house. Trying to follow with them, this is happening.
Okay.
Right.
I'm
sorry,
we
can you
call
repeat
back.
That question?
Yeah. Should I call back or?
Yeah, right. Call me back because I'm being
okay, good. Let me just do one thing. Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. We're rejoining our interview with Will Allen at UFODC.com. And, Will, can you hear me now?
I can hear you fine. Thank you.
Oh, good, good. We were just kind of honing in on the differences between the 1952 UFO flyover in which there was a chase by F-86 Sabres, and the July 2002 flyover in which it was scarcely noticed, and in which you, because of your special implant and your special technical capabilities and talents, with very special equipment, are there on the scene and are able to document this. Now, what do you suppose, why do you suppose the 1952 situation was so violent, where you mentioned that jets were being shot down and one of the objects was shot down, and in 2002, it seems to be going by. You actually photographed the same anomaly, but there isn't any of the overt war going on. What do you speculate as to what the difference is?
I think in 1952 it was more obvious, and there were more people out at the time. And the events, from what I gather, transpired early evening, going more towards sunset and into early the early twilight of the evening. While the encounter I had was less obvious, and obviously it was very limited people out there. There was myself and the talents from this record label that came to town from New York for this job, and that seemed to be it. And, I mean, the difference is, of course, by the fact that 50 years difference, the difference in technology, the differences in film, the fact that I had a high-definition Nikon on a tripod, my samples just happen to have been forensically sound in the sense that the camera was able to photograph exactly what was there. So, I mean, we have our differences in technology, but outside of that, it was not noticed by a soul other than myself.
Now, have you ever speculated on what intelligence was behind or is behind, say, the 1952 anomalies and why there was this shooting war?
Well, I can't say, but one of the things that was presented to me over the last few years was are the images taken by Betty and Barney Hill. And one of the samples that Betty took showed this luminous green and yellow anomaly. Well, lo and behold, here's a 1960s sample of the green object that I photographed at the U.S. Capitol building, except this sample came from Betty Hill. So it says to me that the entities or forces behind the 1952 event were also behind Betty Hill's event, which were also behind the event that I photographed in 2002 at the Capitol building. The same ones.
Right. So does that strike to you, is that the grays, or is that?
It's the grays and the hybrids. And the last time that I recall that I awoke and I wasn't home, if you get my drift.
Yeah.
I woke up, and as I looked up from this metal gurney that I'm laid out on, I could see what looked like humans, but the differences were these humans had alien characteristics, the bug eyes. Some of them had bug eyes. Some of them had human faces, but really large alien-like heads. I mean, and we start looking at, for example, most of the abduction cases that took place, that DNA was taken from most of the people that were abducted, especially Betty and Barney Hill. And that that DNA could specifically have been used for breeding applications in creating hybrid extraterrestrials. And that we have to look at as a very close possibility, because those aliens that I saw as a child were great. But, see, they weren't hostile, though.
Yeah, and now this also ties in with something that you brought up at the beginning of the program, which I found really interesting, in which you said that you're finding that these sort of interactions are increasing in frequency as we approach 2012. Now, we're now in May of 2010. Could you elaborate on what you found and why you've come to that conclusion?
Well, an example is for the last 9 days, I've been imaging, again, with my camera at 1/8,000th of a second and at night using the 20,000 ISO setting that the camera's capable of going. It goes a lot higher than that, though, but I'd leave it at 20,000 ISO. But I'm imaging orange vectoring anomalies in the sky, orange vectoring anomalies. And when I start doing research, if you go further into my website, you'll see that one of the things that I've also been able to do is I'm the first person on Earth to physically document UFO activity in HD 1080i using the new D700 Nikon, which I had for 2 days when this object landed in front of me and 18 other people in Baltimore. So I'm getting all of these physical documentations, and at one point, some of the people that I was dealing with would make reference to the possibility that the samples that I photographed were an after-effect to inferior optics or inferior technology used to render the image, and I have to correct that statement right now because everything that I used to generate what's on UFODC.com was state-of-the-art technology and is state-of-the-art technology used by the United States Air Force, used by NASA, used by National Geographic, used by all the major news agencies that publish news information on television or print. It's all the same high-definition technology, so you can't associate the samples that I've shown on my website with inferior optics, which definitely is not the case. And it also clearly shows that if you examine the physics of the overall images and the specific characteristics of the anomalies in the sky, that they could not be refractive energy from light sources that are on the ground. For example, the shot taken from Lower Stennett Park showing the green objects in formation. The green objects in formation are running north and south, and the street lights are running east and west. So the physics of the lens and the physics of the overall characteristics of the geography and the topography that I took photographs of clearly would be impossible for that to be a ground distortion that's based on reflections of streetlights on the ground, especially when the streetlights are running in polar opposite directions. So we completely negate all of the so-called experts that claim to have answers as to how I was able to take these photographs. For example, an individual who did not want to leave a responding email so I could respond to his mindless assertion that these photographs are generated using plate glass lights and cameras in the sky. To me, that's absolutely absurd. Plate glass was used for special effects in the generation of William Shatner's and Leonard Nimoy's Star Trek back in the 60s. You know, so for a person to make those kind of accusations and say, well, it's easy to generate that, but yet are unable to generate a sample so that I could say, okay, well, there's a possibility that these samples were fictitiously generated, which no one has been able to debunk at this level of the game. No one has been able to generate a sample sufficient to say that it was fictitiously generated. But then we have to deal with other specifics, such as the air reports from Air Commander B.C. Lumsden from the Royal Air Force in 1942. How do you dismiss his accusation of a green object that encountered his air squadron over Germany? How do you dismiss Dr. Bruce McAfee's encounter in 1946 in New Mexico with a green sphere anomaly? There's too many other reports of individuals and objects which match with 100% certainly the objects that I photographed at the U.S. Capitol that support the data for people to say that, oh, well, it's fictitious. It can't be fictitious. It's forensically authenticated.
Well, now, these objects are now increasing in frequency. Now, 2012 is a very charged term or a charged year. There's a lot of prophecy that has been stated around that
speculation
year.
Speculation is more the term. Speculation.
Yeah. Speculation. And since you mentioned that, I just wanted to put it out on the table. Do you think that these objects are cued into 2012, or is that just something that you mentioned?
I believe they're queued in, and one of the things that I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it to Robert during the time he wrote the book, but one of the things that was really interesting about that night, July the 16th, 2002, at the U.S. Capitol Reflection Pool, one of the things I thought was most abstract was during the course of the evening, after imaging, I'd say, about an hour's worth of UFOs, I saw what appeared to be ancient Mayans walking around the Capitol, and they were walking around, they were looking around like, you know how a person just jumped off the bus from out of town, and they're off the bus, and they're in the middle of a city they've never been before, and they're looking around with amazement at everything that's around. That's what these Mayans were doing as they were walking around the Capitol.
So there may have been a Stargate, or these may have been time travelers.
Or they could have been abducted and released at that time, and that's a strong possibility. You know, the Mayans just disappeared. Where did they go?
I see.
Good possibility. They were yanked up, taken to the planet where the Anunnaki are, and that supposedly is the 12th planet, which during the 20,012 rotational axis of the planets, the 12th planet is supposed to line up, and it's in counter rotation with all the other planets that are in this rotational pattern around the sun. And, you know, it's all based on speculation.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying there's going to be a coronal mass. Not necessarily. They're saying there's going to be tidal flows and great tidal waves generated by the magnetic fields caused by all the planets in alignment. It didn't happen when the planets lined up. I think about 34 years ago, as I recall, planets lined up. Nothing happened.
Right.
You know? So all of this speculation, it starts to get on one's nerve, essentially, when here is a man in the year 2010 reading ancient tablets that the Mayans created, I forgot how many thousand years ago. There's got to be a margin of error there. And, you know, it's all a matter of interpretation, just like the sonnets of Nostradamus. A lot of that stuff did happen, but then again, a great deal of it did not. So, you know, it's all speculation. It's all random chance. It's just like playing a card game or going to Las Vegas and winning the slots. You know, it's all random. But when you start seeing the frequency of things increase, as they are increasing right now, then it doesn't become random anymore.
Yeah. Well, let me just go back a second to something that you just mentioned, and that is on July 16th, 2002, that you witnessed, quote, ancient Mayans walking around the Capitol. Could you take us through that scene more in detail?
Well, I'm there, and, you know, keep in mind, I'm a professional photographer. That's essentially what I do now as living. And I'm taking photographs, and as a photographer, I'm constantly looking around for things to photograph, things that would, you know, be interesting in terms of a visual sample that you could present to someone in a presentation. Well, I'm sitting there photographing this client, and there's no one basically around us. We're basically, I'd say maybe about 10 or 15 other people there, but I can't recall anybody even noticing any of this. And off in the dark part of the reflection pool were these group of 5 to 10 people. I'd say more about 10 people, and they were dressed in Mayan, or what I think to be Mayan, clothing, feathers, beads, nothing that would be consistent with anyone that would be a modern person in that century, year 2000, photographs taken in 2002. Nothing that would be reflective even of South Americans in 2002. Nothing that was reflective of that. They looked like the Mayans that were in Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. That's how they looked.
Were you able to photograph them?
Actually, no. For some odd reason, it just never dawned on me to point the camera towards them and take a picture because I just felt they were tourists. And like most tourists, I just don't want to take my camera and just start taking a picture of you if you just happen to stand in front of me.
Right, right.
So I let that go and focused more on the subject at hand, which was trying to get my pay for this album cover that had to go into production in New York. So
right,
I focused
right.
primarily on the subject and not on the subject going around the subject, which were the UFOs.
Yeah, and this was the same album cover subject where there were entities inside the reflecting pool swimming around him. Is that it?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Could I just ask you for the record, what was the name of the record company again?
Def Jam Records.
How do you spell that?
D-E-F-J-A-M.
Oh,
Def Jam.
Yeah, so that's
Def Jam.
A major
it's out of New York.
Company.
It's a major label. Yeah,
yeah.
I do major label artwork. I originally worked at Warner Brothers and Island Films as a director of photography for motion pictures. So I'm trained in film. My training in film came from the Central Intelligence Agency Film Lab that was stationed on base at Clark Air Force Base during the Vietnam War, and they taught me film processing and imagery technology.
Right, so this is now. Do you feel that at any stage in your life you have gotten a communication from the intelligences who are, say, communicating to you through to go out and photograph this or who are behind these encounters that are communicating to you about your mission or their intent or, you know, giving you some text or some content or some history or some planning, you know, some in-depth information other than what you're sort of piecing together from what you're photographing?
I get the notion to go out and take pictures. And when I get the notion, generally speaking, something inside me will say, okay, set the camera to this setting, take 9 to 15 images, this is point and shoot. And I do that.
Right.
And I continually do that. Now, in some of those sequences are anomalous objects that were not seen while I took the photographs. So the camera has the capability of registering light sources, obviously, that are non-registerable by the human eye. So, yes, I get the impulse to take these photographs. I get the impulse to be certain places. And when I go to those places, as I'm directed to, without hesitation or without anything at all, the events take place, and I photograph the events. I get it. So I'm directed to do that.
Right.
But in a subconscious manner. And never am I at a point where I'm compelled to do it and do or die in a do or die situation. It's not like that at all. It's mainly to be there. I set up, I do as I'm told, and I take the shots. And in the shots are UFO anomalies.
Right.
Multiple images of that.
And what sense do you have of the intention of the intelligence behind the anomalies?
I believe first it's to show me first that they're there, and it's second to demonstrate the level of technology that they command. Mm-hmm. And my samples clearly show advanced technology, Stargate technology, resonant propulsion technology, definitely superior to anything that we have with our forward flight technology.
Right. Do you have any sense of intentions toward the human race?
I'm not really sure if it's a hostile intention, because I can't say that through all of my encounters from childhood to this point that anything hostile has happened, other than it's been extremely abstract, and you would never at any point in your life ever consider seeing hypervelocity UFO just suddenly appear in front of you, stop long enough for you to take a picture, then warp out. You know, you'd never in your life expect to see that, but you have to expect the unexpected, and the unexpected has happened on more than one occasion. And for some reason, And I believe it is the implant that's inside me that these objects seem to want to show up around me and allow me the opportunity to photograph them, and I do.
Right. You know, you probably have a unique reality, Will, among us, what, 6 or 7 billion humans on this planet. I have not come across a person with as unique a reality as you and providing a service for humanity and also providing a service for the intelligence behind these anomalies. I mean, sort of a go-between. You know, communicating to humanity and I wondered if you wanted to leave some words for our audience about how that role feels.
Well, it's interesting, and one of the people that I'm conversing with is Stephen Hawking, and Stephen recently came out with the fact that extraterrestrials are real and that most people should generally avoid contact with them, which I have to agree, and especially that, for example, the green anomalies that landed in the Taft Park outside of the Capitol, where the objects landed, and that was in 2002, Discovery sent a crew, the first contact crew, to do some research on my encounter and the 1952 encounter, which they also interviewed Howard Coughlin, who was the original 1952 air traffic controller that made the radar sightings of the objects above the dome, and that these specific objects just happen to be a reality, and that they're here. You know, there's no other explanation other than they're possibly based here. There are places they could be based that we have not considered, like the depths of oceans or in South America, such as Lake Titicaca outside of Peru, which numerous people have seen large objects enter and leave the lake. So we have to look at the realities that, first of all, we are not the only intelligent life form here at all. By far are we the only intelligent life form. And secondly, that these entities may not necessarily be hostile, and that there may be greed in terms of the greed of man associated to the disappropriation of power and the way things are destabilized in today's society. So I can't necessarily say that those aliens that I encountered were hostile at all. In fact, they may be what I am today and possibly helped me get the job in the White House and the things that I did with the presidents that I worked for. I can't say how I was able to do that other than I had the blessing of coming across an advanced entity that was kind to me as a child.
Some theorists advanced the proposition that a civilization such as you are documenting and interacting with and encountering is what they call, quote, a hyperdimensional civilization, that is, they're based in another dimension, not necessarily in a place here on Earth, say, at, you know, the bottom of Lake Titicaca, but rather
exactly.
In an adjacent
dimension. The bottom of Lake Titicaca is, in theory, a portal. Yes, it is. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And especially the sample from the Capitol showing the object vibrating into another dimension that clearly indicated interdimensional flight capability, and that's something we don't have. And that's that repeating patterns in the sky. This is a film sample here, and I've got digital blocks registered on an analog sample. What does that say? It's impossible, first of all, for it to get a digital pattern on an analog piece of film. It showed whatever this object was, it vibrated in a continuous manner, in the sense that each pattern was exactly the same space, exactly the same space apart in space, but in a different coordinate. So that kind of capability, vibrational capability to change your molecular structure to another dimensional, is quite possible.
Wow. Well, we are very grateful that we finally have been able to have you as our honored guest here on Exopolitics Radio, and we look to being able to come back to you as developments occur in amazing field. If people in our audience want to follow your work, what's the best way for them to do it?
Well, they can go to Amazon.com and type in their search, UFO Forensic Files, and my materials are there.
Okay.
Or UFODC.com or National Geographic, anywhere. My materials are there.
You're also on Facebook, correct?
I'm on Facebook. Just go UFODC at AOL.com. It'll take you directly to me.
Excellent. Well, thank you very, very much, Will, and we look forward to we're going to be following your work, and we look forward to your next visit on Exopolitics Radio.
Thank you, Alfred, and I can't wait to come back on the air.
This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned. Thank you.